From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ed Conard has a particular perspective on the American economy, the perspective of a man who's bought, rebuilt, and sold companies for years, the perspective of a guy worth millions, hundreds of millions, who worked with Mitt Romney at Bain Capital. Everything you've been told about the economy is wrong, he says. And inequality rocks as an incentive for innovation and growth. This hour on Point, a 0.1 percenter speaks on the economy as he sees it. You can join the conversation. Is this the hard truth? We need big inequality to move the economy forward, that it's actually good for everybody. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, Mitt Romney's commencement address at Liberty University. But first, joining me now from New York City is Edward Conard, former managing director and partner with Mitt Romney at the investment firm Bain Capital. Romney helped start Bain. Ed Conard is a big contributor to his presidential campaign, and Conard is out with a new book on what drives the U.S. economy. It's called Unintended Consequences: Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. Edward Conard, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thank you for having me.
So you've lived it, you've done it, you made a lot of money at it, and you think the big narrative that a lot of people are following on the U.S. economy out there today is wrong. Why?
Well, I think there are many aspects of the narrative which are wrong. I could give you a long list, which would take quite some time. But I think one of the points which has gotten a lot of publicity, if you will, is the notion that the economy is very different today than it was in the 1950s when we were capitalizing on the value of cars, for example, and needed big businesses to make them and to produce the fleet of cars and pave the roads. And we needed a worldwide oil industry to get the fuel for those cars. Today, 13 people and 2 years can create Instagram and $1 billion of value. It's a very different set of investment opportunities today than in the 1950s. Individuals were much less important in the 1950s. Successful risk-taking, one could even say lucky risk-taking, was perhaps less important at that time than it is today. And that's had a big impact on our economy, on the distribution of income, the growth rate, and other factors.
Well, let's look at that. We'll go back to the 50s and 60s because your interpretation of what happened then is really interesting. But let's go to this issue of inequality. You got the drum roll for your book coming out was in the New York Times last week from Adam Davidson, I guess. And he focused very tightly on inequality. It is important in your book as well. Davidson wrote, you know, this may be the most hated book of the year. But you're very upfront in saying in the economy on the planet as we see it now, you need great big incentives to pull people out front to do what?
I think to take the risk to find the innovation that will drive this economy today forward, which will create jobs for the middle class and the working poor in our economy. In fact, have created 40 million jobs since the 1980s, have brought 20 million immigrants to our shores, have put them to work, have educated their families, and have created a better life for them. And we have been, the United States, much more successful at doing that than Japan and Europe have. In fact, they stand, I would say, in stark contrast to what we've been able to accomplish in the U.S. We have to look back and ask ourselves, why were we able to accomplish this when they were not?
We've got problems, too, and we'll look at them, but we want to really understand what you see. And the big inequalities get a lot of attention. We've got people who are absolutely gold-plated, and others struggling right now. Well, look at that. But you look at the gold-plated part and say, what, that these days to find the advances in the economy is so difficult, so high risk, that you've got to be ready to ladle giant returns on people who go for them, who try?
Well, I think you're making a mistaken argument about after the fact versus before the fact. This is a classic problem, well recognized in economics, which is what really happens is that a person doesn't know what their success will be or won't be when they start off taking risks. So they know that there's probably a 99% chance that they'll fail, and that if they are successful, there's a wide range of outcomes that might result from that. So after the fact, when somebody has been successful and has found innovation, their outcome is determined. What we really have to worry about is how to motivate people before the fact.
Now, but that's my point. You're saying we're different from Europe and Japan in that we hold those huge potential payouts out there as a motivator. Come on, young American or any American, you want to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars? Here it is. You can have it. You can be 0.1 percenter. Go for it.
Yeah, keep in mind, most of the people are motivated not by hundreds of millions of dollars, but simply by the opportunity to be successful. And they do put their careers on the line. Think about people who walk away from Google and Facebook to try to start up, to create a startup that's related to Google and Facebook. The argument I make in the book is that the payoffs for successful risk-taking are higher here than they are in Europe and Japan, and they are for a number of reasons. Our cost of redeploying labor is lower here, so we've been able to transition to a service economy much faster than Europe and Japan has. Our people are working at companies like Google and Facebook, which give them much better on-the-job training and increase the probability that they will be successful if they take risks. We have lower marginal tax rates, which increase the return. There are a variety of different reasons why the returns have been higher here in the U.S. and the risk-taking has been higher. But I think the payouts that come as a result of that are a function of the gold mine that we're trying to mine. And we've been given a very, very valuable gold mine today to mine. And that gold mine is sending back very important signals. It's saying, send more people down here to mine me. There is incredibly valuable things down here for people. Send another
miner. What's the
mine?
A lot of us are not down there. What's the mine exactly that you're talking about, the gold mine?
Sure. I think two things have happened that are not so well recognized, perhaps. The first is that when you look at computers, they've dramatically increased the productivity of the most talented people. And so spreadsheets, word processing, internet content, internet search, email, all of those things are increasing the productivity of the most talented people. Now, if you held everything constant, increase in the supply of the most talented people or the output of the most talented people would cause their wages to go down. Why haven't their wages gone down? Why have their wages gone up instead? Because the investment opportunities that are available to us to harvest today have changed dramatically from where they were previously. And I think for most of economics, they hold that, what does the structure of the unrealized investment opportunities look like? They largely hold that constant and don't factor that into their thinking. Paul Romer really is the leading economist in this area. But the structure of the opportunities, if you take risk, how much value can you create, has changed dramatically today from where it was in the past. The gold mine is sending back a very important signal, which is saying, get people trained to create the innovation that's needed today and get them to take the risk to produce that innovation, recognizing that 99% of them will fail.
How did your work at Bain Capital, which Mitt Romney helped start, you and he were partners there until not so long ago, how did your work at Bain sort of inform your view of how the economy works, how inequality works, Ed?
Bill Bain taught us a very powerful lesson about business, taught us all a very powerful lesson about business. And that is that companies are in competition with each other, and they have to produce more and more value at lower and lower costs just to stay even. You're in a river and you have to swim hard to stay where you are. And if you slow down, you'll fall behind the other competitors, and your profits are only a function of the degree to which you can stay ahead of your competitors or fall behind, as the case may be. And so what you see from that is that an awful lot of the value that's being created by business, almost all of the value, and I make some estimates in the book, is really being captured by the customers of business, not the investors of the business. And the only value that the investor is capturing is their competitive advantage relative to the other competitors. And that advantage is fragile and eroding quickly and is often generally small, not large.
So you're saying when we see payouts of hundreds of millions, or here comes Facebook with billions, that whatever Mark Zuckerberg makes or the other investors in Facebook is just a fraction of what the general population will profit one way or another from Facebook? How's that work? Why?
Sure. Just take Google, for example. What's the cost to a user of using Google? I suppose that's a small loss of their privacy. Mm. So they agree to take that small loss in privacy in order to have access to Google and use it. I think you would see that the productivity, the effect on productivity from Google is enormous. When I tried to write this book, for example, it's hard for me to imagine having to go to a library, pull indexes off the shelves of articles, have the librarian get those from the library, and me reading them one by one, as opposed to I can get a survey of the literature in a matter of months
with Google,
and get very
sure.
much up to speed.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the value of that to me or to the economy relative to the cost of using it? The cost was very, very small.
So for all the fortunes that have piled up, you're saying you cite a kind of 20 to 1. You say there's for the dollar invested, the payout on that, there's 20 times that goes to society as a whole.
I said it's probably as high as 20 times. In the book, I actually use I say that 85% of the value is captured by consumers and wage earners, and the 15% is captured by investors. It's interesting because Dean Baker in the New York Times piece estimated the number at 5-1, which is, what, 82 or 83%.
Yeah.
So both of us use pretty much the same number, which I said was a conservative number, would satisfy a person like Dean Baker who's going to push back on the number, which is why I used 85%. But I said, let's not kid ourselves. The number really is probably as high as 20-1. And I show you examples in the book as to why it probably is 20-1.
You also say in the book that the credibility of capitalism itself is at stake in the debate that's going on here. And you know, very well know that a whole lot of people look at this inequality and their piece of the American pie these days and say, something is not working for me, Mr. Conard.
Yeah, and I think two things. I understand the frustration, and we are in the middle of a recession, which I talk a lot about in the book and make suggestions for that. So I understand why people would be frustrated and angry, to be sure.
But what's your message to them? It's fine. Just sit back. Let the rich get richer, and it'll come your way sooner or later?
No, I think that I don't think that having another Steve Jobs, finding another Steve Jobs, having someone take the risk to become another Steve Jobs is detrimental to the middle class. I think it's beneficial to the middle class. That's a long-run issue. When we come back, we could talk about short-run issues, which I think would have a bigger impact on employment
in
the short run.
We'll do it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with former Mitt Romney partner, Bain Capital man, Ed Conard, about the U.S. economy and incentives to growth. He says big inequality is working for the USA. His new book is Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ed Conard was a managing director at Bain Capital, a partner there alongside Mitt Romney, did a lot of work together, came out very wealthy. Now he looks out at the economy and says, you know what, these days we've got to have big incentives to pull people up out of the humdrum and make them do special things that will benefit everybody. Now, Ed, I know you're a big backer of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign, and of course this whole argument, you're very well aware, goes right, you know, flows right into the middle of a campaign season. I want to play for you something that's out today. People are thinking about all this with the J.P. Morgan $2 billion sudden loss and all the rest. This is an ad that just came out today from the Obama campaign, and it's slamming Mitt Romney and your former company, Bain Capital. This is I just want to get your reaction. This is former workers from GST Steel in Kansas City. You probably know it well. They tell the story as presented by the Obama campaign here of their company going bankrupt and the mill being shut down after a Bain takeover in 1993, resulting in a loss of 750 jobs.
They made as much money off it as they could, and they closed it down. They filed for bankruptcy without any concern for the families or the communities.
It was like a vampire. They came in and sucked the life out of us.
As I look around at the millions of Americans without work, it breaks my heart.
Bain Capital sought elimination of the pension plan and termination of employee and retiree life insurance and health insurance.
I was devastated. It makes me angry. Those guys were all rich. They all have more money than they'll ever spend. Yet they didn't have the money to take care of the very people that made the money for them.
A new ad out today from the Obama campaign. We're going to hear Mitt Romney at Liberty University later in this hour. But Ed Conard worked with him, worked with Bain Capital. That's what they're talking about in that ad. What do you say to this presentation of what went on there and maybe more broadly the processes we're in the middle of right now in this country, Ed Conard?
I wasn't at Bain Capital at that time, and I am under a confidentiality agreement about talking about specific companies. But I would say if people just take that step back and look at the steel industry as a whole, foreign competition pretty much put an end to the steel industry in the United States, including any investment that Bain Capital might have made. And so a lot of people suffered as a result of that, to be sure. But I could tell you this, we worked our tails off to make companies stronger, to make them more competitive, to make them more successful, to get them to grow faster, because that's how you get a good return on your investment, not by being blindsided by steel imports and having the industry shut down and your company is shut down along with it.
They're talking to the losers in that process there. What do you say to them in this period of, tough economics and high inequality?
Well, I do make an argument. I make an argument in the book that we ought to demand in the short run that importers buy our goods as a condition for having access to our markets.
Importers, like
importers
China.
Into the United States,
okay.
China.
Mm-hmm.
Sure,
mm-hmm.
Importers into the United States is what I meant.
How do you demand that?
Well, I think you can demand anything you want.
Yeah, but I mean, we're in debt to them. They're the low cost producer of a whole lot of items. I mean, Mitt Romney talks that game as well, but. Do we really have the leverage to effectively demand that?
Well, we absolutely have the leverage. They need us far more than we need them. But I think you have to differentiate between the long run and the short run, which is the arguments are often confused. In the long run, we cannot afford to shut our borders down. We can't make for $20 what we can buy for a dollar because we take that other $19 and we hire school teachers and truck drivers and doctors and nurses and other people in the local economy. So if you look back, the cost reductions in agriculture powered manufacturing in the 50s and 60s. The cost reductions we're seeing today in manufacturing are powering growth in the local service economy. We cannot afford to close borders in the long run, but we have a short-run problem, which is that a lot of money is piling up on the sidelines for a variety of reasons. And one of the chief sources of that money, which is piling up, is that the Chinese, when they get our dollars from selling us goods, don't buy goods with those products. They save those dollars and they make them available for the U.S. to borrow. Now, if you take a guy like Paul Krugman, for example, he wants to borrow money, have the government borrow that money and spend it. I say, no, let's go to the Chinese directly and say, if you want to continue to have access to our markets in the short run, you need to spend that money on our goods, which will employ our workers. I think there's a little risk that they wouldn't adjust their policy in the short run for that reason.
Paul Krugman was with us just a couple of weeks ago in the same spot you are now. And he said, you know, we don't have to have this kind of inequality. Look at this country in the 50s and 60s. We had much flatter distribution of income in the United States. And why can't we have that again? What's your answer to that, Ed?
Sure. Let's look at the 50s and 60s. And I think it's very dangerous to make comparisons to those economies because they were very different. But you're capitalizing on the value of cars. You need a huge automotive industry. You got to put 250 million cars on the road. You have to pave 1 million miles of road. You have to have a worldwide oil industry. Those are major scale investments being driven by very large companies. Individuals are much less important in that economy, and the pay and success of individuals are much less important in that economy. Today, 13 people in a computer can create $1 billion of value in 2 years. Now, how do we go and harvest that value?
You say we can't go back. You say in the 50s and 60s, really, it was still the aftermath of the Depression and World War II. The United States was kind of alone on the world stage, and that enabled the kind of growth and distribution we saw then. And what? Now it depends on these sort of heroic front runners who go out and break open some new terrain and then make a bundle.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a heroic frontrunners. I'd say it's just the nature, the structure of the unrealized investment opportunities that lie before us. But we can look, we can compare ourselves to Europe and Japan, have to ask ourselves the question, why have they been so unsuccessful at capturing this value, at harvesting this value, at mining this value that is available to us? The United States has been singular in its success in accomplishing this. And we have been able to use that to grow our economy faster. We've been able to use it to employ a lot more people in the United States over the last 20 to 30 years than Europe and Japan have even come close to achieving. And if we want to continue to achieve those things, you characterize the argument in a way that says, do we have to pay people hundreds of millions of dollars to get them to do that? The answer, I think, is very different than that, which is, it's a little bit like stringing a tightrope up across the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
There's supplies on the other side. There's tarps over them, so we don't know what's underneath those tarps. And we say, who'd like to walk across the tightrope because we need those supplies on the other side of the Grand Canyon? We'll take off the tarp. We'll discover what's in it, and then we'll spin a dial, if you will, and you'll get some percentage of what we find underneath that tarp.
But you've got to be ready for a big payout to get somebody to walk that tightrope, you're saying.
Well, I think if you look at the United States, we have a lot of talented people. We have a surplus of talented people. We have a shortage of risk takers. So I went to school with many capable people, top of the class people, who have decided to pursue professions, if you will not lead to the uncovering of this value. And it's fine. Everybody can be allowed to do what they want, but there is a moral underpinning to the book, which is that talented people have a responsibility to get the training and to take the risk. But we see what happens. We're standing there at the tightrope, and the first guy walks across, and he falls into the canyon, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And 99 later, we're still looking for somebody to take another walk across the canyon. They have no idea what they're going to find on the other side, and they have no idea what percent they're going to be able to capture for themselves versus society. But we know they're going to produce a lot of value for society. Even Dean Baker doesn't disagree with that point.
Ed Conard.
How do you get more tightrope walking?
Please stand by there in New York, Ed. The new book is Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy Is Wrong. Ed Conard, colleague, partner with Mitt Romney at Bain Capital for years. Now he's out and writing about how he sees the U.S. economy. Ed, please stand by. Timothy Noah joins us right now from Washington, D.C. He's a senior editor at The New Republic and author of The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Timothy Noah, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've got an argument of your own, and it doesn't exactly jibe with Ed's. What do you think of his argument? You know, we've got a tightrope to get to the riches on the other side of the Grand Canyon. Inequality kind of comes along with an economy that's going to incent people to get up there, take the risk, go get the riches for everybody.
Well, it hasn't worked very well for the last 10 years, it seems to me. I mean, we've had a nice laboratory condition experiment where, you know, for the last decade or so, we've had very low, historically low marginal tax rates on the rich, and not very much of it has trickled down to those in the middle. Over the last decade or so, the median income has actually declined slightly while we've been showering all this money on the rich. Now, when people argue against the notion that income inequality matters, they tend to take the position that their opponents don't believe in capitalism. Obviously, much of what he's saying is true in the nature of capitalism. You have to have a certain amount of inequality to have a capitalist system. The question is, what level is the level that you, what is the optimal level? What is the necessary level? And also, most especially, the question is, can an economy really endure three decades of growing income inequality?
What's the downside of that? I mean, Ed's point says there's an upside, which I wonder of your opinion on. He says there's a 5-to-1 or 20-to-1 benefit for consumers when somebody makes a killing with a good advance for the economy. So there's that. I wonder what you think. And what's the downside?
Well, the downside is, for one thing, a lot of these, you know, new investments aren't creating a lot of jobs, and that's something we need to worry about. You mentioned Steve Jobs, who was a great man in many ways, but he was not a great job creator. According to one calculation from the Personal Computing Industry Center at the University of California, in 2006, if you took all the people in 2006 who were on the production line of making iPods, which of course were a red-hot consumer item that year, you can have them all over to your house and feed them with a single pot of chili. There are only about 30 of them in the U.S. And overall, even if you include the people overseas, Steve Jobs was not a particularly great job creator compared to, say, Henry Ford. So there's a problem in creating jobs, but I think the immediate problem here is that you can't just incentivize rich people. You need to incentivize people in the middle. If people don't feel as if their productivity increases are going to translate into wage increases, what possible motivation do they have to want to do a better job, to want to see America prosper? The only motivation they have is fear of losing their job, and I think that's a fairly barbaric way to do business.
Timothy Noah's new book is The Great Divergence. Let's bring our listeners in. Holland, Ohio. Brittany is calling. Hi, Brittany. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm okay. What do you think?
I have 2 points.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry.
What do you think?
I have 2 points. The first is that I would say that a lot of the people, I mean, he's saying that not to be upset by people making a lot of money, and I don't think that most people are upset at people like Steve Jobs or anyone who is an innovator or creating the businesses. I think one of the main things is the people who are just not in a position of risk making so much money, the people who maybe are a CEO making 10 times more than their next highest employee, things like that. And then my other point is also along the same lines as far as taking risk. It seems like one has to have a lot of money in order to make that risk. I mean, I'd love to do something, start something, but there doesn't seem to be the assets for people to get off the ground like maybe there used to be.
Brittany, let us pick those up. Thank you very much for your call. Ed, how about it? Brittany's fine as long as there's real innovation that helps the whole economy, but she's afraid there's a lot of people who aren't really offering that innovation, aren't necessarily even taking that much risk. You know, did J.P. Morgan really help us all out with its $2 billion loss? What about CEOs sort of structurally advantaged in their payouts? And we've seen where very often they're not achieving the results that those would suggest.
We, between Tim and Brittany, you've put a lot of questions on me. Let me go back to Tim, and then I'll try Brittany second. Brittany's questions, I think, are more complex and require a deeper thought. But okay, going back to what Tim said, since 1980, we've put 40 million workers together. We had 100 million workers in our workforce. We're up to 140 million workers. This is before the crisis, and we've had a drop-off since the crisis. No other economy has come even close to accomplishing that. Europe, Japan are in like the 20% increase, half of the size of our increase.
You're putting China in a different basket?
China, I'm saying high-wage economies, okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. We've brought 20 million immigrants to our shores. We've given them jobs. We've educated their people. The idea that it isn't working, if you step back and look at the big picture, is far-fetched.
9% unemployment, true, long-term unemployment, a lot of people hurting, lost a lot of savings. I mean, right?
I think you're confusing the long run versus the short run. And Tim does another.
Doesn't seem so short. That's all. It just doesn't seem so short.
I think that
you can do the long run, too. I mean, if you go back 30 years, what you find is that the median income has risen, but it has risen. The increases have been pitiful compared to the increases that we experienced in the post-war years. And they have certainly been pitiful compared to the increases at the very top. Now, you can say that the post-World War II era was unique, and in some way it was certainly different. Every era is different. But I don't think that the United States was the only country during that era that saw prosperity with greater income equality. The same thing was happening in Western Europe.
Ed, what do you say?
I think if you look at the pay of U.S. workers, median pay of U.S. workers relative to Europe and Japan, they have been at worst the same and probably better. I think Tim really refers to the Piketty and Say study, which has gotten a lot of PR. You know, there's a Cornell study out right now that looks carefully at the analysis underneath that. It says, look, you can't look at taxpaying units. You have to look at households. You have to adjust households for size, because if two people get divorced and split to two households, they're obviously going to have two tax returns. That doesn't mean that they're half as wealthy as they were before they got divorced. You have to make that adjustment. You have to make adjustments for taxes, and you have to make adjustments for
any way you do the statistics, you see that there is an increase in income inequality over the last 33 years.
Well, you're changing your argument there.
When you correct it for households, the increase is actually faster.
Tim, I've just got you 30 more seconds here, Tim. Give us your big take then. Do you see no advantage in the inequality that Ed says has put us out in front of Europe and Japan?
The inequality we have in this country is well in excess of what is necessary to have a well-functioning capitalist economy. When you compare the U.S. experience currently to its experience in previous years, and also when you compare it to Europe, you see that we have far more income inequality than we need or we should tolerate, and that the economy is suffering as a result. The economy is not in good health today.
Timothy Noah's new book is The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Tim, thank you for joining us from Washington. Ed, we'll come back and hear you out on Brittany and much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with former Mitt Romney partner, Bain Capital man, Edward Conard, about the U.S. economy and incentives to growth. He says big inequality is working for the United States. His new book is Unintended Consequences. He joined us today from New York. He was a managing director at Bain Capital, which Mitt Romney helped found, the private equity firm there, a partner with Mitt Romney. We'll hear later in this hour, in a few minutes, from Mitt Romney and his commencement address at Liberty University over the weekend. Ed, we lost Tim there, but Brittany's question is still on the table about she's fine with it if it really produces innovation that really drives the economy forward, but she's not so sure that all the big payouts are actually doing that. What about that concern?
Sure. Let me just wrap up with Tim, which is we've created a lot of jobs. At worst, the median has been flat. It's probably risen when you look at the Piketty and Say's data more carefully. I show you that changes in the demographic of the workforce towards immigrants and working mothers has probably masked about another 30% increase in pay. So, you know, even if we had more jobs at the same pay or more jobs at higher pay, it's hard to say that the U.S. hasn't been successful relative to Europe and Japan. The second thing I would say is, it's a little bit of a mischaracterization of the argument. Are high payoffs required to get people to take risks? The real issue is they have a chance for a small amount of the value that they create. Can we make that chance small, the value? We give them the same deal and say you can have a smaller share of the value you create. Will we get as much risk-taking as we have had? We don't see it in Europe and Japan. They stand in stark contrast. We have Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Intel, Cisco, Adobe. The list goes on and on. You look to Europe and Japan and say, where has the contribution been? When are they going to come up with a cure for cancer for us? Because we've certainly come up with an awful lot of innovation for the rest of the world.
Okay, but yet now, here we are. We went off a cliff, and a lot of people have been in pain for years now. I don't think you can just drop that in a short-term bucket and say, don't worry about it.
Oh, no, I don't say drop it in short. Far from it. I believe that there are two factors. There's a very important factor driving the short run, which is people mistakenly believe that losses on subprime loans cripple the banks. In fact, institutional depositors withdrew their money long before homeowners defaulted, and the homeowner defaults have been substantially smaller than were expected in the crisis. And people woke up in 2009 and realized that implicit government guarantees, which had held deposits in place since 1929, didn't work. And today, they have dialed down their risk-taking to compensate for that. The money sits idle, unused. And as a result, the economy has contracted, growth has slowed, unemployment has risen. We have to take steps to put that money back to work if we want, in the short run, if we want to get our unemployment up and our economy to grow.
Without government guarantees, you mean, with a sort of more Wild West profile?
No, I believe the opposite. I believe that we are making implicit guarantees. We have to quit kidding ourselves that we should make those guarantees explicit, not implicit, because the implicit guarantees didn't hold the money in place, and that we need to charge banks for the guarantees that we're making. We need better visibility so we can price those guarantees properly.
You mean
we
guarantee bailouts, you're saying, if they're necessary. Is that what that means, Ed? Or I don't want to mischaracterize it, but I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Sure. I think we're already guaranteeing bailouts. We're not going to let the entire banking system collapse because there's a withdrawal of money from our banking system and we can't sell assets fast enough to cover those withdrawals. And even if we had genuine loan losses, so bad loans, we're not going to let the entire banking system melt down. We are making those guarantees. Let's not kid ourselves. But what happens today, okay, the Fed drops the interest rate to near zero. They dare anybody to use hair-triggered risk-averse short-term debt as if no one learned their lesson. And no surprise that that doesn't increase growth today. So one of the things that we need to do is to make it less risky for banks to loan money and for borrowers to borrow money, because we've seen this movie before. We saw it in the 1930s, 10 years of poor growth and high unemployment, and we saw it in the 1990s in Japan. Exact same movie, but slow growth.
Yeah, but this goes to Brittany's question. You've got a lot of bank CEOs who took a lot of risk. It came back. It was all over their face. They got bailed out. A lot of people suffered. I mean, why guarantee that? What about all those big incomes, which are part of the inequality we see? A lot of people, you know, right and left, look at that and say, wait a minute, what's the market logic and social good of that?
Sure. I think this is a very complicated question. Take a long time to answer. But I think when you look back, my book makes an argument that we were investing a lot more money relative to GDP leading up to the crisis. A lot of that was being poured into innovation that powers growth. You would expect that finance, which finances a lot of that, would grow proportionally as well. The second thing that's happening is we're running up a trade deficit, which is flooding our markets with a lot of risk-averse short-term debt. And there's a mismatch between the savings that are coming into our market and the investment opportunities that are available to us, which require a lot of equity and very little debt because they're risky, innovative investments. And so matching up the savings to the investment opportunities is complex. What we did instead was we used short-term money really to fund subprime consumption, if you will, or subprime mortgages.
Chinese money in no small part.
Well, what really happens is the Chinese buy government-guaranteed debt, mm-hmm. and that pushes other risk-averse investors into the private sector, and they shorten up the duration of their loans to protect themselves. And so we end up in our economy indirectly with a lot of short-term hair-triggered money, which will withdraw very, very quickly. And if we leave that money sitting idle, we will have a smaller economy, slower growing, high unemployment.
Well, we've got
we need to put that money to work
right now. Tom in Lynchburg, Tennessee, you're on with Ed Conard.
Thanks, Tom. Well, you've talked a lot about how we've helped the consumers, and in a market economy, you not only have consumers, but you have the suppliers. And what a lot of people are upset about is that this competition game is doing exactly what happened prior to the 1930s and the Great Depression, that the power of these corporations is pushing down the incomes of people who are actually producing things. And then I think you have the trade thing exactly right, because China is doing the same thing. They're basically buying our industries out from under us and then loaning the money they make back to congressmen who are spending it, through the government. And that's just not the way an economy can continue to go. But I think what a lot of people are just really upset about is this power and money in politics and how it allows these very wealthy people to rig the system in their favor.
Tom, let us pick it up right there if we may. Our time with Ed is short, but Ed, you know, Tom raises that from Lynchburg, Tennessee. Glenn Hubbard, big economist, supporter of Mitt Romney, also raised it in Adam Davidson's piece. He said of you, he said, Ed ought to be more concerned about crony capitalism, about the idea that these big rewards are always going to innovators. What about the concern of rigged continents in the economy?
Sure. I think if you look at politics, you can look at it at a micro level, and I'm sure there's all kinds of risk-taking and lobbying and such going on. But let's look at it from a macro perspective. The innovators here have gotten a higher share of the income in the United States. They've been significantly more productive than the rest of the world. Have they been able to use that political clout to push taxes on the middle class and lower taxes on the wealthy? The wealthy here are paying a much higher portion of the taxes than in Europe and Japan. I think the second thing you could look at is, have they denied people government services? Well, we know that Europe provides more government services, but they do that by taxing the middle class more heavily than we tax the middle class in the United States. So we don't find real-world examples where we see the rich people in the United States on a macro level. I know we can see many examples on a micro level, but on a macro level, where they are being successful in, for example, pushing the taxes off of themselves and onto the rest of
An awful lot of people just don't buy. Here's John writing to us online, Ed. He says, the 1% seem far too willing to devote their willing to devote their money to walling and gating themselves off from common societal problems like maintaining a good system for educating our kids, making sure our water, air, food safe for everyone, like sharing in military duty, civil law and order. He says, hey, 1%ers, you want an unbridled ability to earn. How about an unfettered sharing in the responsibilities of citizenship? That is a very common attitude in the comments coming in here, Ed.
Yes, and I really do. I think the issue is one where do you think that the risk-taking by talented people, a small portion of which produces a lot of value for mankind, is that the best way for them to make their contribution? Yes, I would agree that there are other ways to make contributions as well, but we don't see in Europe, for example, that those have been more successful than what we have done in the United States.
Joe in Wellesley, Massachusetts, you're on with Ed Conard.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking mm-hmm. my call. Mm-hmm. I want to take issue with your guest's absolute nonsense about these corporate executives who are out there taking risks. I've been a corporate lawyer for 35 years, and I've never seen a corporate executive come into a company without having a wonderful golden parachute on the back end of things. I've seldom seen institutional investors come into corporations without having something along the lines of preferred stock or in a lot of instances, getting their money out immediately through things like management fees, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that people deserve these massive rewards because they're risking everything, they're not walking a tightrope across the Grand Canyon. They've got the system rigged so that it's heads they win and tails they win.
Joe, we've got it. I appreciate your call very much. All kinds of golden parachutes. What do you say, Ed?
I think companies need 50 CEO potential employees. I'm 50. I'm pulling it out of the air. They need a lot of CEO potential employees to run a large company. And a number of people have to look and say, I could be an entrepreneur. I could go work in another sector of the economy, but I'm choosing to work in a corporation because I hope to be the CEO and get the same kind of payout doing that as I would if I went down to the gold mine or did something else. And so I think that what you
see
today—
They're all that good. They're all that worth it.
I think most of them don't get paid anywhere near what the CEO gets paid. So there's an alternative, which would be take the CEO pay, divide it up among 50 people. I think if you do that, you'd have a little more pay, or let's call it twice as much pay, for those 50 people. What kind of people are you going to attract? I think you probably attract a lot of people that are attracted to the legal profession, as opposed to entrepreneurs who are really going to try to drive change in an organization and see the pay structure inside of that organization look a lot like their alternatives out in the rest of the economy.
We've got 20 seconds. You're putting your money behind Mitt Romney in this race. Do you think if he wins, we'll have an economy more geared toward the vision that you're supporting here, Ed?
Well, I think in the long run, we will. I think it's what we do in the short run, I think, there's a broad range of things that we might do in the short run. I guess in some ways I'm more concerned about the short run, even though I know the viewers are much more concerned about the income inequality issue, which addresses the long-run issue that's addressed in the book.
Ed Conard was a partner at Bain Capital with Mitt Romney, managing director there. He's out now and retired, but writing about the U.S. economy, Unintended Consequences is the book, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You joined us today from New York. Ed, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Edward Conard of Bain Capital. In a moment, Mitt Romney addresses the class of 2012 at Liberty University. This is On Point. On Saturday, Mitt Romney delivered the commencement address at Liberty University, Jerry Falwell's big conservative college in Lynchburg, Virginia. He spoke to more than 30,000 people packed into the school's football stadium. Some at the evangelical school had criticized the decision to invite Romney because he is Mormon. Romney did not speak about his own religion by name, but he did speak of religious values and religious liberty.
The American culture promotes personal responsibility, the dignity of work, the value of education, the merit of service, devotion to a purpose greater than self, and at the foundation, the preeminence of family. The power of these values, this culture, is evidenced by a recent Brookings Institution study that Senator Rick Santorum brought to my attention. For those who graduate from high school, get a job, and marry before they have their first child, the probability that they will be poor is 2%. But if those things are absent, 76% will be poor. Culture, what you believe, what you value, how you live, matters. Now, as fundamental as these principles are, they may become topics of democratic debate from time to time. So it is today with the enduring institution of marriage. Marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman. The protection of religious freedom has also become a matter of debate. It strikes me as odd that the free exercise of religious faith is sometimes treated as a problem, something America is stuck with instead of being blessed with. Perhaps religious conscience upsets the designs of those who feel that the highest wisdom and authority comes from government. But from the beginning, this nation has trusted in God, not man. Religious liberty is the first freedom in our Constitution. And whether the cause is justice for the persecuted, compassion for the needy and the sick, or mercy for the child waiting to be born. There is no greater force for good in the nation than Christian conscience in action. Religious freedom opens a door for Americans that is closed to many others around the world. But whether we walk through that door and what we do with our lives after we do is up to us. Someone once observed that the great drama of Christianity is not a crowd shot following the movements of collectives or even nations. The drama is always personal, individual, unfolding in one's own life. We're not alone in sensing this. Men and women of every faith and good people with none at all sincerely strive to do right and lead a purpose-driven life. And in the way of lessons learned by hitting the mark and by falling short, I can tell you this much for sure. All that you have heard here at Liberty University about trusting in God and in His purpose for each of us makes for more than a good sermon. It makes for a good life.
Mitt Romney speaking to 2012 graduates at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia on Saturday. To see the video and read the transcript of his full address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You can continue today's conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website as well, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point Radio.